On this edition of Radio Survivor, revitalizing the AM dial may mean more Rush and Hannity on the FM dial.
We're all moving to FM. That is the big headline from the AM revitalization order.
Professor John Anderson helps explain this and also why the nation's second largest radio owner is hitting hard times.
Jennifer Waits takes us on a tour of Radio K at the University of Minnesota.
So what exactly is this room that we're in?
This is just, it looks like just dilapidated vinyl.
And Matthew Lassar explains why every squatter's camp needs a radio station.
Sure, there's Facebook and Twitter, but when the authorities show up, there's nothing quite like being able to cover your negotiations with them live.
Take that microphone and go away.
Hi, I'm Eric Klein. I'm a host and producer of Radio Survivor.
And I'm Paul Reisman-Ellen. I'm another host and producer of Radio Survivor. Thank you so much for taking some time to listen to our show.
Hey, Paul, when was the last time you took some time to listen to AM radio?
Just the other day.
Why did you listen to AM radio the other day?
I often listen late at night when something more interesting or crazy might be on. I probably listened to Coast AM with George Norrie, formerly hosted by Art Bell, and Art Bell's new show is Superior. But George Norrie's show goes on all night and is on the AM radio dial.
Right. The Coast to Coast. That's really the after hours AM radio.
It's either that or it's the trucker station. There's like a trucker's network, right? And maybe some other and sports talk. And that's kind of what I find on the AM dial here in Portland. So I do listen actually on occasion. How about you, Eric?
I have to admit that if I flip through it, it's just for laughs and it's just for a minute until I go back to my five FM stations. So yeah, I don't even think about AM radio. And then here we have John Anderson on, and he's been thinking hard about AM radio and all of the changes.
And we have on the line here Professor John Anderson. He is an assistant professor and a director of broadcast journalism at Brooklyn College. And in radio land, you may know him from his website, DIYmedia.net, where he has been speaking truth to radio power for 15 years,
I think. Since 1997.
1997.
The old man of the blog.
So, before blogging was a thing.
Indeed. And especially you've covered pirate radio, which we certainly talked about the last time you were on the show. Thanks for being here, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
I want to have you on because I want to talk about a couple of issues in radio news. It's not something that we haven't been real topical or you know, up in the moment on the podcast so far. But these are two pieces of news that I think are particularly important for folks in community and grassroots radio to be aware of. And maybe they don't catch because it sometimes seems like maybe it's not so pertinent to them because it affects a lot of commercial broadcasters more so than they. And the first thing I want to talk to you about is the FCC finally released its first report and order on AM revitalization. John, to start us off, can you tell us why does AM radio need to be revitalized?
Probably the largest reason for that is spectrum pollution, band pollution. The amount of noise that exists on the AM dial has increased significantly. I almost want to say exponentially, but I don't want to get caught out by the engineers on that. In the last, you know, like 20 years, 30 years. And this is due to the proliferation of both consumer electronics and industrial electronics that put out spurious emissions into the AM band. So like if you're near a factory, a lot of times the electric motors they'll be using in those are unshielded and you'll hear squealing noises or other noise on the AM dial, which interferes with your ability to receive radio stations. Light emitting diodes, so like LED traffic lights, are quite interference prone. Mm. So if you're ever driving and you pull up to an intersection and suddenly your AM reception is completely destroyed, it's because the LED lights are actually causing it. Home computer equipment, your wireless routers, things like that have caused an amazing amount of pollution on the AM dial. And it's made it very difficult for quality reception, sonically quality reception of these stations, especially as we now live in a digital environment where fidelity is determined by an all or nothing, right? Yeah, it's there. It's relatively clean, or else you don't hear it. And so AM is kind of being seen as a band that's being allowed to degrade. It hasn't been mowed recently. It's a piece of grass that, you know, has been left to kind of just fester. And Ajit Pai, one of the Republican commissioners for the FCC back in 2012, 2013, kind of made this one of his policy hobby horses. And he said, we need to do something to bring new life into the AM dial, deal with some of these interference issues, but also look at how AM radio still fits into an evolving 21st century radio industry.
And why is that important? I mean, why does he feel like we need to do that with AM? I think a lot of folks don't even listen to AM because they think of it as mostly just a bastion of AM, of conservative talk radio or talk radio you don't care about, or sort of forgotten formats, you know, sort of like beautiful music and nostalgia formats. They don't really think of it as something which provides a lot of ongoing service. So why the attention to the band?
Well, because Pi's from Kansas. And I mean, that's actually kind of an important point. AM broadcasting is actually a regional or national or international level of mass communication. It's actually pretty much the only terrestrial radio, except for maybe shortwave, that could be considered to be like mass geographic coverage areas. And there are different classes of AM stations all the way from A to D. And the lower down you get, the less power you can run, the less time you can spend on the air. And larger stations, predominantly in major markets, the Class A stations, it's often been used as a primary mechanism to engage with radio for people that live outside the cities. For example, I'm from Wisconsin, and my hometown is 35,000 people. When I was growing up, a lot of that was farming and factory workers. And we didn't have a local media outlet with our own FM station. So we listened to the AM radio, and we often listened to the big stick AM stations out of Chicago. So if you're living in a place like Kansas or the Dakotas or Montana, where you don't have a lot of population density, AM can be in a very effective way of reaching those audiences. And it's rural listeners that are most affected by the degradations that I was talking about that are happening to the AM band.
This is wonderful. I haven't thought about AM radio this much in a long time. And now I feel bad about that. It really, because I agree with Paul's earlier statement that, if you scan the dial on AM, if you even have that technology anymore, it does. It's all bygone junk. I mean, you can sort of get a thrill from experiencing AM radio again. But really, the idea of a nutritious meal of information on that frequency is hard to come by. I wonder if there's anything left worth saving. Like, what's good about AM radio?
Well, I think, and I've said this before just about radio more generally, it is the medium of last resort when it comes to communicating to a society. When you look at things like, natural disasters and whatnot, other communications technologies fail or they become prohibitively expensive to engage with. So, for example, when Hurricane Sandy came through here, because we're, a couple years out from that now, 3 years? I can't even remember. But it happened today. That many years ago, we watched, broadcast television, FM, we watched the internet, especially the cell network, begin to be dismantled by Mother Nature. And so a lot of people, went and dug around in their drawers and they found a radio that had AM reception so they could listen to 1010 Winds and WCBS and WNYC and the stations that were actually providing meaningful information. I think the kind of thing you're describing about like the lack of value on AM programming wise is due part to the notion that the band has been allowed to disintegrate and get noisier. But I also think it's due to the fact that the AM broadcast industry itself really shot itself in the foot back in the 70s and 80s. They had a chance to adopt a stereo broadcast system, which would not have nearly rivaled FM radio in any way, shape, or form, but it could have maintained or at least staunched some of the bleeding that took place as music formats left for FM. And when that happened, the FCC basically said, we're not going to make a decision on the technological standard. We're going to leave it to the marketplace to decide. So basically like three or four companies invented their own AM stereo transmission and reception technologies, and there was no coherency. You could buy one radio that had a certain AM reception technology, but it wouldn't decode the analog signal coming in from the radio station that's not using the same technology. It was just a mess. And so, So AM stereo pretty much withered and died on the vine, and you were left primarily with what a lot of people describe now as a telephone-like audio quality. So you're going to be pretty much limited to your types of speech programming and your lower fidelity, easy listening music of your life type, style stuff. But I also think, yeah, you're right. It's also been co-opted to a certain degree. It is the predominant domain of the right wing and a large part of its media machine.
Yeah, there's a lot of churchy stuff.
And you're also seeing like foreign language broadcasters leasing out, buying time, brokering time on smaller power, you know, AM stations as a way to attempt to reach a larger community. So while it doesn't really hold a candle to FM, doesn't hold a candle to Sirius XM, doesn't hold a candle to streaming, AM still has unique communicative properties that deserve to be maintained in some form, and the FCC is now starting to think about what form, ultimate form, the AM dial will take a few decades down the road.
And so the FCC acted on this. I know broadcasters have been waiting for it for years, and the report and order just came out. John, what's the headline? What's the big news?
We're all moving to FM. That is the big headline from the AM revitalization order. The notice of proposed rulemaking that was put out a couple years ago had a laundry list of things that the FCC was willing to consider to help revitalize the AM dial. And pretty much everything that they initially considered in that first proposed rulemaking, they have now codified and adopted in the report and order. So changes to the way that where AM antennas can be sited, how they can be designed, the efficiency of them, the need for AM stations to protect each other from interference. Those things are being revised. AM stations are being allowed to use a slightly different transmission method, which can save on the electricity costs of running a transmitter. You know, these are all kind of piecemeal that things possibly that you should have done over the last 20 years, but never got around to doing kind of stuff. But then there was this part in there where they said, you know, AM radio stations could really use FM translator stations in order to help basically keep their coverage area sustainable. If you're a daytime only AM broadcaster, it means you have to go off the air at sunset every day. And so you're really only broadcasting halftime to your audience. And that kind of sucks for those stations who are trying to make a go at it like that. So giving them an FM translator would allow them to simulcast not only their daytime programming, but they would be allowed to stay on the air and cover things like, you know, the local high school football games. And there is a huge market for FM translators that has developed in the last dozen years. Translators are regularly selling for 5 to 6 figures each, and they're used for a lot of different reasons, including getting around local radio ownership caps to rebroadcast HD only signals. But they've also been used by AM broadcasters to provide some of this relief. The ironic thing is though, it does nothing to help the AM dial. Because moving to the FM dial and giving people more spectrum on a band they've never historically existed on before doesn't really seem to have any material effect on the AM dial. In fact, it seems to suggest that the end state for the majority of AM broadcasters in America will be FM. I think we'll still see, you know, the 50,000 watt Class A big market stations existing. They'll still be able to provide a wide coverage area. But even those folks are lining up FM simulcasts. So, you know, remains to be seen how it's going to play out. But yeah, FM was the headline out of the AM revitalization order.
So, John Anderson, I'm confused. I'm going to assign you a task to become a science fiction author now. And if you're going to project like 8 years into the future and predict what AM radio is going to sound like, it's not just empty static, right? There's got to be something there.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there will still be AM radio stations that will exist. There are still AM radio stations that are profitable, in part because they use syndicated programming, don't have a lot of staff and, you know, that sort of thing. And they also cover a large geographic area. So like your larger stations, your Class A AM stations will still exist. But I think the bottom of the barrel Class C's and D's may use this opportunity after they get the FM translator and see, you know, if it makes any fundamental difference in their viability. Eventually, I think what's going to happen is they'll come to the FCC and say it's no longer economically viable to run a flea power daytime only AM signal that gets stomped on by your Wi-Fi router. So we should be able to stop being an AM broadcaster. It's no longer economically viable, and you should allow us to do some sort of magic convolution to make our FM translator rebroadcaster our initial broadcaster. So 8-10 years down the road, you're going to have a lot more FM signals on the dial. Those FM signals that we're going to see come online here will initially be rebroadcasting AM stations, but a decade down the road, they will become, I think, standalone FMs. And so you'll have more static between what stations still exist on the AM dial. Then again, there's always pirates, and pirates often utilize spectrum or chunks of spectrum that commercial or public broadcasters do not consider viable. So yes, we're not going to watch AM go away or be sunsetted like we're seeing in certain European countries right now, but hopefully it'll be less drivel. And we'll definitely see a much more packed FM dial out of it.
And I think one thing for listeners to keep in mind who may not be familiar with translators, they're repeater stations. And for commercial stations, they must have an originating station that they are repeating the signal of. So if you have a translator on the FM dial, it must be fed its program signal from an existing full power station. So at least for the moment, every AM station that gets a translator on the FM dial has to remain an AM station as well. They can't just simply abandon yet. What John was sort of talking is that in the future, he suspects that that these AM stations will go to the FCC and say, you know, the AM station is no longer useful. Just let us be FM.
Yeah, wasting our money with this. Right.
And I mean, it's interesting that in the rulemaking that just came out, the report and order that just came out, the lower power and lower priority stations, the Class C's and D's, are going to get the first crack at any FM translators, existing translators and new translators. There will be a window for AM stations to apply for new FM translators in 2017. Interesting thing is though, that if you're an AM station and you acquire an existing FM translator, like you find it somewhere within 250 miles and move it into your market so you can use it like this, you're required by the FCC to rebroadcast your AM station for just 4 years. So after 4 years, those AM broadcasters could repurpose that FM translator for something else. If you get a new translator from the 2017 filing window, you have to run the simulcast with your AM station in perpetuity. So it may be interesting too, like after 4 years of existing translators being acquired, the AM broadcasters say, oh, we can make more money, you know, leasing this to Clear Channel or iHeartMedia, for it to rebroadcast an HD2 signal or something, right. You know, so there's still a lot of unfortunate flexibility within the FCC's new regulations on this. And it'll just have to watch and see what happens.
Why unfortunate flexibility? Why?
Because, I mean, we're seeing the end game of a massive change in the way FM translators have been used in the United States. Up until about 2002, 2003, they were considered these secondary signals that weren't really that economically viable, that people only used in areas where they needed to make up some coverage gaps. And there were changes in the rules regarding translators that have turned them into effective standalone stations that are now traded and speculated in and sold on the open market for 5 to 6 to 7 figures, you know? So the money, it's like having a hot piece of property. If you can have a piece of property on the FM dial that you can develop in a more profitable way than simulcasting your AM, you may consider not simulcasting your AM. And the FCC's rules allow for that possibility to exist.
Yes, and the thing about translators as well is that, I mean, they are effectively low-power stations. They're capped at 250 watts, which is only 150 watts more than the cap on low-power FM, which are non-commercial stations that must originate their own programming. They exist, though, basically in the same engineering pocket.
Well, true, but FM translators have one huge advantage over LPFM stations, and that is they can put their antennas up as high as they want. So if you put a 250-watt FM translator on a big skyscraper or a mountain overlooking a town, you're going to get kick-ass coverage, which could be equivalent to a full-service, lower-priority station on the FM dial. But LPFM stations can only get their antennas 100 feet off the ground. And coverage in FM is as much, if not more, a function of how high you get your antenna as how much power you run. Which is why they are so lucrative for companies to get and develop and move into markets and treat as standalone new stations.
So you guys, if I understand correctly, then are talking about a situation where the rules are making it easier for the kind of radio that I have the opinion is not that good is being privileged over what I would also consider better radio. Like community radio stations and low power FM stations could have some of this real estate, but it's being left to the big boys to play with.
I'd agree with that to a certain degree. I mean, there have been some innovative LPFM broadcasters that have acquired their own translators. And when they do that, you know, they actually get a larger audience because the signal's more robust. It's 2.5 times the power. It might be sited in a better location. And so even though they're running the LPFM's kind of there to feed, you know, this other thing. So, I mean, that's happening, but the majority of the money, the majority of the stations, the translators themselves are being snarfed up and traded between religious broadcasters and commercial broadcasters.
And should low power FM stations be worried? The one worry I've heard repeated a number of times since this order came out is, will my low power FM station, my existing station, be threatened by all these new translators? Will it be forced off the dial? Will they be sited so close that we'll experience interference?
Well, for that, you know, I always look at Mishi Bradley over at Rec Networks, and she wrote up a wonderful kind of summary of the report and order as well. And her take on it, and she's way deeper into the regulatory morass involving this than I ever will be, is that no, you don't need to worry necessarily so much about getting, you know, punked off of your frequency by a translator because you're in the same basket of priority. It's not like translators have more priority over LPFMs. So they can't bump them off the air. LPFM owners need to be vigilant about whether new translator stations will be coming into their market, whether they'll be located on the dial, and whether or not there is the potential for interference. And that's kind of a pain in the ass. But does it represent an existential threat? Not so much. And like Michi, I would say that the biggest concern is that any chance for another LPFM window down the road has been pushed off at least for another 2 years. Translators are going to get the next bite at what crumbs of FM spectrum are remaining. And if there's anything meaningful left over after that, maybe 2020, you know, LPFM could get a third bite at the apple. But yeah.
And yet there are a few more questions still out there to be answered. And we will certainly be covering that at radiosurvivor.com. And people should look to your website as well. John, you've done some excellent coverage at DIYmedia.net. And actually, one quick point I want to make on this, but before we leave it, is that one option that was in the original sort of set of questions the FCC put out was giving stations the option to go all digital on the AM dial. And that was not addressed.
Not really. In the original report and order, you know, they said there is this all digital AM HD technology. That's the supposed end state of HD radio will be all digital AM and FM. But it hasn't been tested to any significant substantive degree, at least back then. And they just kind of put it out there as, could we use this initiative as a way to attempt to maybe also revitalize interest in digital broadcasting? HD broadcasting. I actually filed comments in this proceeding saying, no, no, you should not use this proceeding. The most, the proper proceeding for that is the digital radio proceeding you have going on. And so, no, they didn't really make any mention of all digital except in just kind of a litany of things they're considering for the use of the expanded AM band. And they've said, as one of the things they're considering, should we give primacy to new stations who want to go on to the expanded AM band if they will commit to adopting all digital? But like I said, that's one of many options and questions they're considering. So it's pretty much like a non-entity at this point. No one is really spending any time or attention on advocating for increased digital radio adoption on AM, I think in large part because the initial adoption was so bad. The technology did not work, and right. So many people have turned it off. I mean, it's too bad because there's other digital radio technologies that we could use in conjunction with HD, and this could really provide an opportunity for us to consider those technologies, but that's so far outside of the realm of common sense at the FCC as to not even be viable.
And the expanded band is all the frequencies north of 1600 kilohertz, yep. Correct?
So like 1710, yeah. I want to say. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, and that was added on in the 90s, yeah. I think. And so older radios don't get it, but newer radios do. Yep. And so there's fewer stations there because it only came into existence in the 90s. But I want to move to another story. This is about the second largest owner of radio stations in the country. And I think most people are familiar with the name Clear Channel, now known as iHeartMedia, but they're often less familiar with that number two is this company called Cumulus. And they've recently had kind of a big shakeup happen that looks like it really does threaten the company.
Oh, yeah. I just looked up their stock and it has tanked today. Shares of Cumulus Media are now worth 46 cents.
And we're talking on October 30th.
Yes, October 30th.
46 cents each.
Close of market, 46 cents a piece. Oh, my gosh.
And that's fallen from what? Do you have an idea of what it was maybe a year ago?
So let's see. About a year ago, the stock was actually around $4.
So not necessarily amongst the top stocks on the exchange, but nevertheless valued at something like 8 times greater than what it's valued at today.
Wow, that's incredible. I think we're getting close to the point where the actual value of the market capitalization of Cumulus is going at or south of $100 million. The entire company, I'm saying, is considered mm-hmm. worth to Wall Street around or less than $100 million as a whole, the second largest owner of radio stations in the United States. And just to put that into some perspective, the HD radio system we've been talking about that no one seems to want and hasn't really been adopted was just sold to another technology company for $172 million.
Wow.
So the market values a nearly non-existent digital radio technology almost twice as much as the second largest broadcaster in the United States right now. This is bananas.
So what happened? Well, let's kind of come from the most recent events and go backwards. What's happened most recently at Cumulus that seems to have drained market confidence from the company?
They haven't been making money, and they've been acquiring businesses for which they had absolutely no idea what they were going to do with them. Cumulus is an interesting story because it really started out as a company with good intentions run by a family, the Dickies, based in Ohio, that were really interested in running small market stations and providing service to a community and treating their employees with respect. But Cumulus is one of these Frankensteins conglomerates that have been created by the Telecom Act of 96 and how it removed national ownership caps. And the Dickies were very savvy in exploiting the market forces at play there to effectively, you know, acquire and grow into a massive conglomerate. So from 1997 on, they began acquiring companies larger than them, like Citadel, which was, you know, where all the ABC radio stations were located. And they've
I like how Cumulus rhymes with accumulate.
Yeah, that is true. That is very true. And they've just, they've done more than 100, maybe more than 200 acquisitions in the last nearly 20 years. And some of those, most of those have involved broadcast companies, large and small, but they also acquired major content distribution networks like Dial Global and Westwood One. They got into...
What does that mean, content distribution
networks? So like Dial Global and Westwood One are syndicators, basically. They carry syndicated programming. So when you're an affiliate and you want to take the programming, you do the deal with the syndicator Westwood One. They're the ones that are feeding you the programming, right?
So isn't that Vertical, yeah. Right? That's what they call that.
It's part of vertical integration. And they got into luxury publishing. They bought an online streaming audio platform. And we've seen this actually in a lot of large commercial, you know, Wall Street finance broadcast companies over the last decade. Broadcasters themselves have kind of pulled a lot of their equity out of their companies, and they've replaced it with private equity firms. Firms that are coming in to invest, to make money, and sometimes get out. And private equity firms control a significant stake in Cumulus now, and they have not liked the downward trajectory and the fact that they miss earnings and the fact that there's not a lot of coherency between all these tentacles of the company. And they've taken it out on the company, and they've taken it out on the Dickies. And they were let go. Pretty much, I mean, one of them is still a vice chair at the company, but one was pretty much let go and the other was demoted.
One was CEO, yep, correct? Yep.
And the other was demoted, and they brought in, they promoted somebody that they'd brought in earlier this year on their board of directors to be the new CEO. And this person, interestingly, has a history of putting publishing companies through the bankruptcy process. Navigating the bankruptcy process. They made a bet that they could continue to acquire and that Wall Street would support that acquisition frenzy, but they didn't know what to do with all the pieces to make them work together. They got egoistic and greedy, and now they've fallen and the company is sliding down pretty hardcore. Wow.
And one narrative people often take away from hearing this news is that, well, see, this is old media. Radio is dying. It's not profitable. Just take a look at it. This is why, you know, internet radio, podcasting, online media in general is ascendant and radio is dying. Does that match these facts?
I don't really think so. I really think this was a case of two country boys biting off more than they could chew. And getting really Google-eyed with money and being treated like captains of industry, but being completely out of their league and not having the sense to acquire the staff they needed to properly run their own organization. So it's not necessarily that this is a testament to the irrelevancy of radio. It's a testament to the irrelevancy of stupid business models, which detrimentally impact radio's effectiveness and communicative ability. Cumulus is still worth a lot more than Wall Street is valuing at it. Maybe it's worth more in pieces sold off. Cumulus, like iHeartMedia, has actually sold off a significant portion of their transmission infrastructure, the tower sites from which they broadcast. Both of those companies have sold that off already as ways to pay down the debt that they've built up in acquiring so many other companies and building the conglomerates they have.
They sold their real estate.
They sold the real estate. They still own the transmitters, but they don't own, and they still own the antennas, but the towers that they're all bolted on. Nope, that's in somebody else's hands. And there's actually consolidation in the tower market happening pretty significantly in the United States right now.
So right now, Cumulus owns 460 stations. That's as of February 27th, 2014. It might even be fewer now. And as recently as 2011, they had 570 stations. So they've been sort of selling them off sort of slowly. But the company had a revenue in 2013 of just over $1 billion. So it does make money, but I guess what's lost in that is profit, huh?
Yeah. In the process of going through the acquisition frenzy that Cumulus has conducted over the last, you know, decade and a half or so, they've racked up something like $2.5 billion in debt. And that's typically in a revolving line of credit. And you're basically, when you get to that level, just like you would when you max out too many credit cards, you're basically servicing the interest. You're just trying to service the interest on the payments. And you can't do that. It's not sustainable.
So this Radio Titanic is sinking. Are there good people who are going to lose their jobs? Are there anybody left who is making radio that we would have admired their work at this point? Or is it all just people servicing robots anyway?
No, I'm pretty sad anytime that a company like this goes through struggle, because there will be good people and people we may never hear who are doing radio and working in radio because they love it. So yeah, there will be some problems, but you know, the company still has to announce what it's going to do. And I think they're having their earnings report, you know, conference call next week or sometime later in November. So we should be able to hear more about that. I'm just doing the math right here. 121,400. So they have 121.4 million shares in the market, right? And the shares are currently worth 46 cents. $55.8 million.
Yeah, that's a very low market capitalization. And certainly amongst the people whose jobs may be threatened are journalists who work for ABC Radio, because ABC Radio is actually owned by Cumulus, even though the brand is a Disney brand. Westwood One, big syndicator. So that includes any number of syndicated commercial radio programs as well. They have a very large sports department, which provides the Super Bowl broadcasts, many NFL broadcasts and things like that. And certainly those are our place with a lot of employees.
One of the things that Cumulus has done that's been pretty interesting and seemingly like a good financial move was they launched a national country music brand called Nash FM. And this was a really big deal a couple of years ago. Like in New York City, there hadn't been a country music formatted station for something like 16 years. So, you know, bringing one back to town was a big deal. And there's been a lot of investment both in talent syndicated and at the local level, making connections to the music industry that seem to be a more coherent piece of the broadcast pie that Cumulus finds itself in. And I know that Mary Berner, the new CEO of Cumulus, has already like gone to Nashville and spoken with people that are involved in the Nash FM effort. And it seems like that may continue, but man, if the stock keeps tanking like this, people just might start panicking, you know, at the company and making cuts simply to satisfy the demands of what they need to do in the next 3 months. And you can't win like that. You can't win.
And this is really the story of over-leveraging. I mean, it's the same story as Clear Channel, now iHeartMedia, which is now owned only by a capital firm. There are no publicly traded stock in iHeartMedia.
Yes, and they're carrying $20 billion worth of debt. $20 billion.
Yeah, much of it just from buying up stations and then buying up, you know, related and often unrelated businesses.
iHeartMedia sold off the majority of their towers last year, a couple of years ago, for several hundred million dollars, which seems like a big deal. But if you think about how their debt is structured and when it becomes due to pay back, they effectively sold off their broadcast infrastructure to make an interest payment on the debt. People should look at Cumulus and see, okay, this is how things can go bad in a hurry with sheer ineptitude. But iHeartMedia, you know, while it has already pivoted and redefined itself as a content discovery company, as opposed to a radio company, there is still a huge financial albatross hanging over that. And by the end of this decade, iHeartMedia may find itself in similar dire straits. We'll just have to see.
So you've laid out a picture where there's just two monstrously huge companies that are, correct me if I'm wrong, but making a lot of crummy radio. Like they make less good radio now because they're so big, right? Less local radio, less high quality content. Like what there used to be in America before these monsters ate all the other stations, and it's a result of policy choices made a generation ago now in the mid-90s, Is there a way to like turn back the clock? Is that even a discussion at this point? Like, can you get local radio back now that these juggernauts are failing?
I don't really know. I don't really think so. What you end up seeing is you see new consolidators come about, like Alpha Media. Isn't that in your guys' backyard of Portland? They are assembling portfolios of stations on a national scale. There is Town Square Media, which is another company that has been quietly assembling a portfolio of radio stations over the last decade or so. And so, you know, as the dinosaurs die off, the mammals come out. And you see a transition in how life happens. But will the life itself go away? I don't know. Hopefully we can get good things out of their carcasses if they both do go into some sort of spin, bankruptcy, dissolution phase. But still too early to tell, really, for both of them.
Yeah, part of the problem, I think, is that the dinosaurs have overgrazed, if we will, the vegetation. you know, because part of the business model early on of the consolidators was in buying stations was combining ad revenues. You know, one big tactic was to take two or three stations and to sell their ads as a package rather than individually. And so in so doing, in a local market, if you're a car dealer and someone approached you and said, we get you on three stations for what you pay for two, you go with that, right? It's cheaper ads. And because the consolidator has consolidated staff, which means firing staff and been controlling costs on that side, their profits go up because they're keeping their costs down. But what that does in any given market is it drives down the cost of radio advertising. So this has happened, the great devaluation, which was probably going to happen to some extent anyway, because that's happening in all of advertising, but it was sort of accelerated in radio. And so they've come through and cut down the expectations of what an advertiser expects to pay for radio advertising, which is their principal method of making profit. And so the new companies have to come through, and this is the market they're dealt. This is what they're dealing with. They have to sort of figure out how to reconstruct in new financial realities, many of which were brought on by the industry itself, not brought on by necessarily by external factors like the rise of the internet. I think that's certainly one of the things. I wonder, John, do you think that these new companies might learn from the example set by Clear Channel and Cumulus and might see that it would be wise to cap themselves and not expand beyond a certain point and not overaccumulate other businesses and not overaccumulate stations? Do you think that's even possible?
I really don't know. Part of me, the curmudgeon in me, wants to say they will not learn. You hear a lot of good talk out of these nascent consolidators saying we're going to do things differently. We understand the importance of local programming. But at the same time, like, economies of scale are profitable if done right. You were talking about advertising and how the advertising landscape has changed. Just look at the rise of things like big box stores and the increase in consolidation in radio. If you look at the number one advertisers on radio, they are chain stores. And that's a significant transition in the advertising market that's directly correlated to the fact that you're selling advertising en masse on multiple stations. And we're also seeing the human element being taken out of the advertising sales process. What I mean by that is that we're seeing stations not have a lot of sales staff anymore as they gravitate to something that's called programmatic ad buying. And that sounds very complicated, but it's basically like if you buy Google AdWords, you know, you go onto Google, you go to AdWords, you say, I want to get these keywords. They give you a price, you hit okay, and you're done. They're applying that same type of philosophy in how to sell radio spots. And so leveraging that technology to dehumanize the process probably means, and let's face it, we're not going to see the profit motive as a priority driver change anytime soon. So yes, maybe the business will get more efficient. Maybe the nascent consolidators will live up to their promises. The question is can they actually prove that value, that mission is valuable to their own investors? Some of whom will be private equity firms or others, especially if they decide to make a go of it on Wall Street. there's actually been a really good discussion on a podcast called Radio Stuff about the Cumulus Meltdown. It's a very tongue-in-cheek and acerbic take on the history of the Dickies, how they built their empire, and some of the controversial things that they were involved in over the course of their tenure at the top of this media empire. It's almost kind of a karmic just desserts laugh along. And I would
is it their former employees?
No, I think it's a fellow Ohioan who loves broadcasting and hates what the Dickies have done to it in the context of their company. This podcast samples from C-SPAN hearings when the Dickies were brought forward to talk about the effects of consolidation and corporate censorship on the media. It's good stuff. And the music zingers he's got in there is just awesome.
We'll definitely have a link to that in the show notes at radiosurvivor.com/podcast. Well, we'll keep watching this and because it does affect what we receive as communities on our radio dial. And as Eric brings up, it affects the jobs, the journalists, the hosts, the salespeople, the engineers who are employed in radio. It affects it. It does affect, I think, our whole communications ecology, even if any of us individually are not big commercial radio listeners, there tend to be these grand sweeping effects that do end up also affecting people who are in non-commercial radio. John, thank you so much for helping us out and helping us sort of untangle these two big stories in radio. And of course, they should be reading your website at DIYmedia.net.
Always a pleasure.
Up next, we'll have College Radio Watch with Jennifer Waits.
Jennifer, you were just in Minneapolis at the College Broadcasters Incorporated Student Media Conference. How was it?
It was great. A good time was had by all, including me. it was an action-packed few days. I flew in on a Wednesday and the conference wrapped up on a Saturday afternoon. So many full days of sessions. It started with some pre-sessions on Wednesdays. They had an advisor get together, which I didn't attend, but I thought you would be interested, Paul, as a former advisor.
Mm-hmm.
They had a gathering. And then they had some tours set up for local stations as well. And then the conference went into full swing on Thursday, and they had between 6 and 8 simultaneous sessions going on at any given time. So it was a pretty big conference, lots of different options. I presented on 2 different panels. I talked about college radio history on one panel, and I did that with Mike Lupica from WPRB at Princeton. So we shared our advice to actually a really packed room, which was gratifying. I think we inspired some people to get started on history projects at their stations. And then I also did a presentation about my college radio station touring. And it was sort of a whimsical, fun presentation where I had pictures of mail tubs and Leo Blaze signs and walls of CDs and vinyl and all the crazy things I see at radio stations.
And just real quickly, what is a Leo Blaze sign?
I keep seeing this sign when I visit radio stations, and it's a handmade sign out of cardboard that just has the station's call letters on it. So like KFJC. And after seeing them at a bunch of different stations, I finally figured out that there was this guy named Leo Blaze who handcrafted signs and sent them along with his CD that he was trying to get stations to add to their station. So he's a musician, and he handmade all these signs and sent them all over the country. And I eventually figured out who it was that was making these signs, and I did an interview with him on Radio Survivor. But it's become, for me, kind of like a scavenger hunt. Every time I visit a station, I ask, do you have one of these handmade signs? It's kind of this silvery gray color and it has your call letters. And either people look at me like I'm crazy or they walk me over to the Leo Blaze sign.
Right. And I guess he made a lot of them, but he didn't sign them. So it did become kind of a bit of an investigation to figure it out.
Well, he did actually sign them, but I think, you know, the person receiving the sign may have kind of forgotten or didn't tell anybody who it came from. And then the signs get placed maybe on a high shelf somewhere. And he signed it in, you know, pretty small letters on the side of it, on a side that you wouldn't see normally. So he'll write, you know, to KFJC from your friend Leo. But most people don't seem to notice that signature.
Right.
But then when I go to a station and mention it and we pull the sign down, there it is, the little inscription.
And so for the conference as a whole, is there do you have a big takeaway, or were there any themes that seem to dominate more than any others?
You know, it's weird because in other years, there's definitely been an overwhelming theme to me. Like when we were on the heels of LPFM and I went to a CBI conference, I felt like that was in the air. A lot of people were buzzing about LPFM. When we've had these major station sales, that's definitely been in the air. And this year I didn't get kind of a big theme coming out of everything. I think people in general seemed very positive and excited about college radio. And there were people from all over the country there. You know, there's always this excitement about meeting people from other stations because we often don't get out of our own insular worlds. So one chance to do that was at a swag swap, which they have every year, where people bring materials from their own stations, like t-shirts and stickers and buttons, and you put them out on a table and people walk around and trade swag. And some people brought some really special swag that they were kind of holding off to the side, waiting for some really amazing item to come along to trade it for. So that was interesting this year.
So anything really interesting, unusual, or very cool?
There were, let's see, unusual. WRFL had these kind of super special hats that they made, and they seemed kind of customized, almost like trucker caps. They only had a handful of those that disappeared pretty quickly. There were some air fresheners from KXLU, and it's not necessarily unusual. There were like maybe two or three stations that brought air fresheners, like car air fresheners that hang, but it had, you know, the logo of the station on them. But what I didn't realize is that you can order them in a whole variety of smells. So you didn't know what smell you were getting. It could have been coffee or peppermint. And I guess when you buy them, you get this assortment. So that was a swag revelation to me. Radio K from University of Minnesota, they brought a bunch of stickers. And then later when I visited the station, they had Radio K record inserts, you know, that you put inside a 45 or a 7-inch record that has a larger hole so that you can play it on your turntable. And I thought that was brilliant. I don't know why we don't see more logoed record inserts from college radio stations, because that's useful and it kind of fits with the whole idea of college radio, which plays vinyl.
Right.
So that was one of my favorites, actually, was the record insert. You know, it's always fun to see like the different t-shirt designs that stations create. I like that part, and I like bringing home things and bringing them to KFJC where I DJ, so that people there can see, oh, this is what other stations do as far as promo items.
So you would say that overall, then, it was sort of a very positive kind of gathering, that folks were very enthusiastic. And I assume there must have been some attendees who are currently building their low power FM stations. Is that correct?
There were definitely stations there that have recently launched their LPFM, including students from KTRU at Rice University. And they were all excited. They brought their new stickers that have their new frequency on them. So I got a new, brand new KTRU sticker with the current frequency.
And about how many people were in attendance?
There were over 300 attendees this year. And I should point out, it's the conference is for electronic media overall. So I was told that it was probably around 2/3 radio folks. So that included mostly college radio, but also a handful of people from high school radio stations. And then you had people from college television stations and I guess, these converged media outlets where maybe you're doing a little bit of web stuff, a little bit of television and audio.
That's great. And then you had a chance to go to a College Station there in Minneapolis, Radio K.
Yes. So as you know, anytime I go out of town, I try to visit college radio stations in the area or radio stations in general. So one of the stations I visited in Minneapolis was Radio K, and its call letters are K-U-O-M, and it's at University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. So I went there just a few days ago, actually, and it was kind of this crazy three-hour tour, like Gilligan's Island or something, where I had this incredibly passionate tour guide. He's a junior named Paul Benson, and he had all the time in the world on a Friday afternoon to show me around the stations. So for me, that's like my dream tour, because I could stay at a radio station for hours on end. And he didn't have anywhere to go, and he enjoyed exploring things at the station he'd never seen before with me. So it was an incredible tour, super fun. I saw every nook and cranny. I saw places that aren't normally on tours when they tour people around. The station itself occupies pretty much a whole floor of this building on campus called the Rarig Center. And I was kind of blown away by how massive their space is. They've got lots of different studios. All the different spaces seem to be behind these closed doors, so you don't really know what there is until you open the door, and then there's something magical behind it. Either it's a studio or a production room. They've got a large live studio where they have live bands play. It's pretty much like a professional recording studio, and it even had an area sectioned off to put drums, which I'd never seen before at a radio station, where, you know, they're even thinking about putting drums in a separate space so you don't have sound spilling over. And that room also had a disco ball, which I thought was cool, and a piano, too. And then one of my favorites, they had all these hidden closets that were full of music. So
what exactly is this room that we're in?
This is just, it looks like just dilapidated vinyl. Edgar Winter. I'm finding all of the vinyl of songs that we're playing for our Halloween show and marching band.
So do you come in here and
poke around? This is one of the first times I've actually been in here, just because I can't like steal any of them or upload them to my computer, so I guess I just haven't explored all the weird vinyl that we have.
Are you guys able to play 78s? Do you have a 78 needle?
Oh god, I don't know.
Because look, this is probably a 78, super fragile.
How do we know? It's just sound effects. Oh my god. This is airplanes. Continuous airplanes.
This is 13 army planes in formation.
Because if we're out of formation, it sounds different.
And then in that same closet, there were a bunch of 1970s, like very mainstream KTEL records. So these collections of mainstream hits from the 70s. And a Jimmy Swaggart record, and then like some really cool punk 7-inches, like all in the same closet.
Am I correct? Is Radio K an AM station?
Yeah, so Radio K has a really fascinating history, and it's an AM station that dates back to the early 1920s. And they also have some FM signals as well that they've added more recently. But yeah, it's 770 AM. And it covers quite a bit of the state of Minnesota. So it's unusual in that it's a college station that's AM. And it's also really special, I think, that it's such an old station. The history is a bit more complicated, though, because the AM station started in the 20s. And then at some point, a campus-only carrier current station also started called WMMR. And then in the 1990s, the two stations merged to become Radio K. So it's all one station now, but they used to have a couple different radio projects going on the campus.
And Carrier Current, for people who don't know what that is an AM station, but it broadcasts using the electrical wiring. So it means that you can receive the station with when you're in proximity to like an electrical outlet. And it was often a way that people used to broadcast campus radio inexpensively, because a full-on AM transmitter is actually a pretty big and expensive proposition.
And it's also... a way to do it without being FCC licensed. So these stations could get on the air without having FCC oversight. So I think at University of Minnesota, they might have been in maybe five different dorms. And it had quite a legacy. Actually, Garrison Keillor came out of WMMR.
And you did a full-on write-up, as you usually do, of Radio K. And we can connect to that in our show notes.
Yeah, in record time. Often it takes me weeks to write up these pieces. And I don't know, the station in particular, I couldn't get the visit out of my head. So I needed to write it up immediately. It was haunting me.
Indeed. Well, they'll be able to find those show notes at radiosurvivor.com/podcast. And of course, your radio college radio watch feature comes every Friday. And if they just go to radiosurvivor.com. Thanks a lot for this tour, Jennifer.
Oh, sure. It was great.
Up next on Radio Survivor, we have Matthew Lassar's contribution with Lassar's Letter on Radio. This week's segment features some of the kinds of words that you'll never hear on the FM dial because they're not FCC friendly. So if there's anyone in the room or inside of your earbuds who doesn't want to hear that stuff, you have been warned.
This is Matthew Lassar with Lassar's Letter on Radio. You're listening to a community radio station documenting police in Australia forcibly tearing down a squatter center in Sydney. This happened sometime in the mid-1990s.
Bastards!
What, mate? This
is just get off the property.
We're not your mate, sorry.
Look,
and we're glad of it too. What if they're your mate?
Okay. What'd you do with his mouth? This guy's bleeding from his mouth. What did you do to him?
What's his number?
Get his We've number. Got his number, the scum.
Fuck off, mate.
If you kick that once more. You fucking stupid man. Your sticks, eh?
I'll give you a choice.
Yeah,
you keep your mouth shut or you'll be in the back of the truck charged with offensive behavior.
Okay? Spread them as
The radio station was Skid Row Radio. It shared an occupied city building on Broadway with a community food center, a free legal advice co-op, and a bookstore. When the sheriff arrived to throw the squatters out, no surprise that the first thing he noticed was the radio equipment.
Take that microphone and go away.
You can say that you're acting under your instructions, but we'd like to talk to somebody that we know can give the instructions, and that's got to be the town clerk or Vic Smith.
Oh, I see. That's
I mean, we've been through enough with this council to know where we stand, and we know that we can talk to these people, and they've should come down here and talk to us.
I then suggest that you go and talk to them at the appropriate
place.
No,
we've been talking to them enough, and they should come down here and talk to us.
Well, I'm asking you to leave, Father, to leave this time. I'll ask the police officer to reject you forcibly. And if need be, take people into custody and charge them.
Well, that's not what we want, but we want to talk to the people that are in charge.
This is what I want, and this is what I want done. And you're here illegally. You are aware of that you are now appointing closed
premises. Yeah, and you know why we're here, and you know what we've been through and how we've been treated by the council. And for that reason, we would like to speak to somebody that is going to come down here and speak to us and not just stab us in the back each time we go up there to speak to them.
Ask them to leave.
The takeaway from this forgotten trove of audio is that if you're going to do urban squatting, it's really useful to have a radio station around. The signal allows you to explain to the public what you are trying to accomplish. Sure, there's Facebook and Twitter, but when the authorities show up, there's nothing quite like being able to cover your negotiations with them live. Skid Row Radio is still around to this day, by the way, and so is squatting. Last year, a whole bunch of squatters got thrown out of Sydney's Miller's Point area, with income inequality, housing prices, and rent skyrocketing, I expect we'll see plenty more occupation of unused land. This is Lasar's Letter on Radio with some free advice to all occupiers. Grab yourself some airspace as well.
So what happened? Oh, I was just trying to walk in the door and a cop punched me in the face. And I went to the ground and they dragged me out the back there and just threw me out against the wall and started going, tell me to piss off.
So they took you out the back where no one could see you?
Yeah.
Do you think that's reasonable behaviour from protectors of public law and order?
No, not at all, but that's only to be expected from scum like that.
So not only should squatters consider having their own pirate radio station, but I like the fact that those guys and gals, they knew how to hold a microphone. Mm-hmm. That was a very well-produced live event there with an uncooperative guest. You know, every word that the sheriff said was on mic. So kudos to those radio producers. I hope they're doing well today.
Unlicensed radio has been used in these situations many times over, in fact, in the last 20 years in particular. And one of the longest running unlicensed stations is Human Rights Radio in Springfield, Illinois, run by Mbana Kantako is the name of that broadcaster. He originally started it as the Tenants' Rights radio station for the Tenants' Rights Association in public housing in Springfield, Illinois, and had broadcast a number of confrontations with both authorities and the FCC, or taped them for later broadcast. So indeed, a radio station does allow you to make this stuff very rapidly public. It's a lot in the way I think people now are using social media,
right? And live streaming
and things like this. But radio, of course, only requires that you have some electricity and a place to put an antenna,
right? And there's no data caps.
Another fun show. Thanks so much to John Anderson for joining us for that great discussion about Cumulus and the revitalization of the AM dial, which means moving things to the FM dial. Also, thanks to Jennifer Waits for giving us that great tour of Radio K and catching us up on the College Broadcasters Incorporated Conference. And, of course, thanks to Matthew for that great little slice of audio from the squatters camp there in Australia.
That's right. You know, I noticed recently that I don't know if in any of the recent podcasts we've mentioned how much work is on radiosurvivor.com and how much of that is Matthew Lasar and Jennifer Waits's blog work. They're writing up a storm there every week along with yourself, Paul. And someday maybe I will match that effort just in fractions. But their work there on radiosurvivor.com should be mentioned here on the podcast in case we have podcast listeners who aren't blog readers.
Yes, and we want to invite you to our new forums, Radio Survivor Forums, which is at radiosurvivor.com/forum, where we really want to encourage discussion about many of the ideas and topics, whether it's about the podcast specifically, things we bring up, or anything that you would like to discuss about radio, whether it's from the operations side, how to create, how to maintain a radio station, how to create a podcast, or you're curious as a listener, or you're curious just as an enthusiast. It's open to the public at radiosurvivor.com/forum. And we're following a little bit on, I think, the ideas of Ken Friedman that we've talked about here on the podcast, who is creating Audience Engine, along with the great folks at WFMU, who sort of encourages stations and community journalism and community media projects to own their platforms, to bring these conversations into their own platforms. Because while Twitter and Facebook and other platforms can be great, somebody else owns it. The terms of service can change tomorrow. Your ability to access old conversations or even find them can all of a sudden get very difficult. And we want to do this as more of a community supported and very open and honest endeavor with
right.
our forums.
The non-data mined version of a community.
Yes, we are not selling advertising against it at all. And so you will not all of a sudden see some ad that's based upon some keyword that you just typed into your response.
Yeah, and that Ken Friedman episode of Radio Survivor was number 10. So long ago now, number 10 is the episode where he describes to us the Audience Engine project that we're looking forward to seeing how that develops. There's probably a little more information now out in the world.
They're about to have a debut, in fact, this week
well, we'll
for the fundraising engine. They're going to have a big soiree in New York City. And we could really use your support to help us continue to do both the podcast and the website, and as well as our newsletter, the weekly Radio Survivor Bulletin. Go to radiosurvivor.com/support, and there are different ways that you can help us out with a little bit of money to continue doing what we do. And of course, if you have any comments, we'd love to hear them. Email us at podcast@radiosurvivor.com, or you can tweet us. We're at Radio Survivor on Twitter. We're also on Facebook too, but we'd prefer email or using our message boards.
Sure. Yeah. You don't have to stay in those blogging silos, as I've heard somebody call them once on the internet.
We don't need to be on the silos or in the silos.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. It's been another nice episode of Radio Survivor.
Thank you.